in the limelight. In the US, the Food and Drug Administration on Friday, 29th of October, granted emergency use authorization for a lower dose of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for children aged 5 to 11, marking a major milestone towards making a population of around 28 million kids eligible to be vaccinated in the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by Kaya Hubbard, a general news reporter at US News and World Report. The piece is titled, FDA Authorizes Pfizer COVID-19 Vaccine for Kids 5 to 11. In the United States, the Food and Drug Administration on Friday, 29th of October, granted emergency use authorization for a lower dose of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for children aged 5 to 11 years old, marking a major milestone towards making a population of around 28 million kids eligible to be vaccinated. This is a day so many parents eager to protect their young children from this virus have been waiting for, Pfizer's Chief Executive Officer Albert Bourla said in a statement. Over 6 million children in the United States have been diagnosed with COVID-19 since the start of this pandemic, and a high number of young people continue to be infected every week. With this FDA authorization, we have achieved another key marker in our ongoing effort to help protect families and communities and to get this disease under control. The agency's Vaccine Advisory Committee earlier this week announced overwhelming support for use of the vaccine shot, which Pfizer estimates to be over 90% effective in the age group. The decision now heads to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's Vaccine Committee, which will take up the issue early next week, making the shots available to kids as early as midweek. The Biden administration has already published its plan to distribute the vaccine shots should they gain authorization, which includes sending the shots to more than 25,000 pediatric offices and other primary care sites, over 100 children's hospital systems, and tens of thousands of pharmacies. Hundreds of schools and community-based clinics will also get them. But making the vaccine shots available does not mean the majority of parents will be on board. According to a survey data released this week by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 3 in 10 American parents say they will definitely not get their 5 to 11-year-old kids vaccinated against the coronavirus, with the majority citing potential unknown long-term effects and serious side effects of the vaccine as the main reason for their concern. Still, getting a large share of the child population vaccinated would have a big impact on the pandemic's outlook, according to the country's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci said at a recent press conference, "If we can get the overwhelming majority of those 28 million children vaccinated, I think that will play a major role in diminishing the spread of infection in the community." In announcing its authorization of a lower dose shot made by Pfizer and BioNTech for the 5 to 11-year-old age group, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said clinical trial data showed the shot was safe and prompted strong immune responses in children. The most common side effects were fatigue, fever, and headache. Infectious disease experts say that with approaching holiday travel and family gatherings, widespread vaccination of younger children could be a game changer. It could help keep classes in person reduce the likelihood of quarantines and lessen the risk of transmission to older, more vulnerable adults, as well as protect the children from what has become the eighth biggest killer in their age group, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. To date, nearly 2 million American children aged between 5 and 11 have been infected with the coronavirus, and 8,300 have been hospitalized. A third of those hospitalized were admitted to intensive care units, and at least 170 children have died. But a report this month from researchers at Northeastern University, Harvard University, Rutgers University, and Northwestern University found that parental concerns around the COVID vaccination had increased significantly from June through to September. Chief among them, researchers said, were the newness of the vaccine, whether it has been sufficiently tested, its efficacy, its side effects, and long-term health consequences. According to a survey released on Thursday, 28th of October, by the Kaiser Family Foundation, scarcely one in three parents will permit their children in this newly eligible age group to be vaccinated immediately. Two-thirds of parents were either reluctant or adamantly opposed to giving vaccine shots to their children. An Axios Ipsos poll found that 42% of parents said they were unlikely to have their children vaccinated.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all our dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. السلام عليكم Sister Zainab.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Welcome to the show, and I am Hassanain. We're living in a world like filled with problems and solutions.
Okay, I agree with the problem part.
Yeah, like they say that, you know, if there's a problem, there's also a solution for it. So we're almost in the end of 2021, just a couple of months left.
I know, that's insane.
I'm all, if you recall, all this year we have been going through a pandemic.
Yeah, ain't that lovely?
Yeah, so like, you know, the different problems, you know, we come across problems in our daily day-to-day life, you know, from pandemic to Taliban to genocide, like different problems.
Yep.
What do you do if you come across a problem? What do you think, like, basic problems? You just bought a new shoe, and it doesn't fit you properly. What do you do?
Dude, try the shoe first when you're still at the store. That's your solution.
Let's just say you just come back from the mall, you come back from the store, you're trying a new shoe, and it doesn't fit you.
Go change the shoes. Yeah, go change the shoes. Swap them for shoes that fit you.
So what do we understand from this?
that's the solution of shoe size problem.
Exactly. You know, people, if they come across any problem, they start blaming. Mm. Either they blame themselves or they blame others. But the simple thing you're supposed to do is, you know, try to solve the problem.
There's a fine line between playing the blame game and trying to find the source of the problem, mm-hmm. in order to provide yourself with a solution, yeah. right? Sometimes you kind of need to know whose fault is what it was,
right.
to get to the bottom of things and find a proper solution for it.
Right.
And when you see a certain pattern from someone, yeah. right, things keep going wrong in your life, and mm-hmm. that person seems to constantly be the source of it,
yeah.
you think to yourself, it's time I get a new shoe.
Yeah.
That shoe thing that you said, I feel sometimes applies to people as well.
Mm-hmm.
It does. Find new people in your life game.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes someone always complains about something.
Mm.
You know, one person is blaming 10, and those 10 people are blaming the same person. Over here, majority wins, right? So this one person is wrong.
No, that's not always the case.
No.
Misunderstandings happen. Misunderstandings happen. But what's important for us is to be objective about it. Brothers and sisters, we're going to go on a short break, so please stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
See, in the case of the shoe, I don't want to keep bringing the shoe up, but you don't blame your foot,
yeah.
all right? You don't blame your foot for not fitting in the shoe. You're mm-hmm. like, okay, the shoe, I need a new one. This yeah. one just doesn't fit me.
Mm-hmm.
The same is in life. You feel like, you know what, this person is no longer compatible with me.
Right.
We no longer have the same objectives. We no longer have the same understanding, the same worldview, the same intentions.
Yeah.
This relationship, in other words, is turning toxic.
Okay, not just about relationships, right? Like if you talk about, you know, like personal problems. If someone has a problem, you know, what I think is you were saying that, you know, we need to get objective.
Mm.
So in the sense that, you know, if we have any problem in ourselves, like, you know, sleeping problems, you know, getting up early, we cannot do that. You know, mm. if you're having any problems,
mm.
you know, nowadays I think that, you know, people, they're getting in a state of mind
mm.
where they're starting to live with the problem. And like, nah, I'm just like this. I cannot change.
Maybe they don't see it as a problem.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Well,
they're just living with the problem. And
what's wrong with that? They don't see it as a problem. It doesn't create any impediments, any problems for them in their life. Like, okay, for example,
mm-hmm.
I can only speak for myself. So constantly yeah. putting myself as example, I'm a night owl. I do my best work and my most creativity is during those late, silent, peaceful hours of the night. I'm not a morning person at all. Mm-hmm. And I don't like morning people either. Because
yeah,
they get on my nerve. Get out of my face.
But after all,
I want to sleep.
Yeah, but after all, we're helpless. Like we have our classes in the morning. Now, let's
do it. How often do we allow ourselves to uh-huh. remove someone from our lives when things aren't working out? Imagine you have a roommate who's
okay.
an early bird. You are a night owl. Your roommate wakes up early in the morning, makes his coffee,
yeah.
brings out his books, decides to buffer the couch and vacuum the room and
yeah.
makes a lot of noise. What do you do with that? You haven't slept all night. You were up working and studying and working mm-hmm. on the projects and PowerPoints, and now you want to sleep. What do you do?
Okay, first of all, I'll try to converse with that guy. You know, like, it'll try to adjust our timings. So I might sleep earlier, or he might, you know, change his time of, you know, cleaning the room and making all sorts of noises. So
maybe he can, like, do the more quiet activities.
Yeah,
more
quiet activities, and he can shift his, you know, the daily chores of cleaning his house and
mm.
all. You know, he can shift it to some other time. Mm. I'll try to converse with him.
That's good.
But I don't think you're going to do that.
I'm going to change my room. First of all, I wouldn't have a roommate to begin with. Secondly, I'm going to change my room because, you know, It's not her fault.
Let me give you an example.
Give me an example.
If you go to a store to buy a shoe.
Yeah.
Sorry for getting that again. You know, you find a perfect size for your feet.
Yeah.
And the shoe fits perfectly.
Yeah.
Then after that, you feel that if I take one size bigger, I'll be more comfortable.
Yeah.
But what does the shopkeeper say?
The shopkeeper, he would tell me to take both so he can make more money.
No. Okay, so, you know, apart from that.
No. My point is that I don't, I feel that life is too short, mm-hmm. right? I'm not saying that I'm an intolerant person mm-hmm. or that I easily delete people out of my life.
Yeah.
I have a very small circle of friends and close people, intimate people, and there's a reason for that.
No, wait, let me continue with my example.
Okay.
You know, the shoe fits perfectly in your feet, but after you feel like, you know, if there were a size bigger, so it would have been more comfortable.
Okay.
You know, the person whom you're shopping with, they tell you that just take this one.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start using it, like gradually, it'll loosen itself.
It'll loosen up. Yeah.
And it'll get more comfortable with you. You know, if you take a bigger size, it'll get more loosened up, then it won't be comfortable.
Well, I get that.
So, you know, some matters are solved with the period of time.
Ah.
Like, as time passes, some matters are solved. But there's
some.
Some, exactly. That's why I said some.
Yeah, the key word here being some.
Some.
Or even maybe everything needs a little time, all right?
Yeah, for example, like, you know, since we're talking about shoe, our friends shouldn't be like, sorry for using the word, they shouldn't be like socks.
Mm.
Like, we change it every day.
Mm.
You know, if you don't understand someone, we change it every other day.
Mm.
So, like, first, like, we should, you know, like, we should stay with them, like, at initial stage. You know, we should try to adjust.
Mm.
We should check if they're improving.
And if they're worth it. See, this
exactly.
is what I
if
was
if they're
saying.
Worth it.
If they're worth it. Try to give everything a little time,
yeah.
but at some point you will feel that, you know what, this is not worth the energy I'm investing into
exactly.
this. Whether it's a friend, it's a roommate, it's a major,
exactly.
you know? Sometimes you choose a major in life and at first you're iffy about it. You're like, I don't like the professor. I don't understand this topic. My classmate is a little on my nerves. And then a little time passes and you're like, okay, I can live with this.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. It shouldn't be like, you know, you're changing your clothes every day. You change your friends, you change your colleagues.
Or your spouse even.
Okay, now here, over here, it gets really sensitive. You know, how you act with your spouse and what you do with your spouse.
Mm.
Like, it's your married life. She's your wife. And you're supposed to live your whole life. You're supposed to spend your whole life with him or her.
There are going to be problems.
What are you
going
to do, you know, if you're not able to understand your spouse?
There definitely are going to be problems. No relationship in this world is perfect, except maybe the relationship between Rasulullah and Sayyidah Khadija, salamullah alayhima wa alayhima. But in spousal relationships, I feel that there are red lines. You can resolve everything, but the moment he raises his hand on you, that's your red line. You can resolve anything. The moment she disrespects you in front of the children, that's your red line.
Yeah.
You can resolve anything. The moment this person becomes a risk to your deen,
so exactly,
to
you
your
believe
akhira,
that, you know, there's some limit or some
absolutely.
Red line.
Absolutely.
It's not like, you know, just...
Yeah, let's just try. Let's just
reasons.
Have another baby. Let's just have another... Because babies are not solutions to spousal problems at all.
Yeah.
Whoever thinks that, I mean, come on, read a book. We're going to go for a short break and be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us again on today's episode of Youth Station. So basically, in every situation, I feel that you have to weigh, if it's worth it. Like in the case of a roommate, I can just switch my room. You know, I don't need to spend time, energy trying to, you know, it's not that person's fault they're an early bird.
Right.
Not my fault I'm a night owl. Just switch your room and get on with your life. So first, weigh if it's worth it.
Yeah.
And then try to invest some time and effort into bettering it.
Like,
and then
like,
draw
you know,
your boundaries.
Like boundary can be over there where you think you're not able to adjust with the person. I think you shouldn't get yourself in some mental, you know, you
drainage.
Yeah, disturbances.
Mm.
You shouldn't disturb yourself mentally.
For sure.
The place where you think that you're getting pressurized or something like that, that might be a red line.
Yeah. You feel that it's harming your mental health, your physical health, your spiritual health, you know?
Or there it might be wasting of time.
Yeah, exactly. So I think those are really important. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam where His Eminence says, "The unlucky is he who cannot find friends, but unluckier is the one who has friends but loses them."
That's really deep. Yeah, that's really
so
deep.
It means that Islam isn't about that cancel culture, deleting people out of our lives. But on the other hand, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam says, solitude is better than a bad company. So the moment you feel like this person is harming your akhirah, your spirituality, your mentality, your health, your well-being in general, it's not worth the time, the energy, the effort, no matter who they are. Sometimes even family member.
Right.
You know, sometimes even blood can be toxic.
True. Like, we shouldn't also forget that, you know, it's not always the shoe, you know, that's small in size. Sometimes the problem might be in ourselves.
For sure.
And we're just simply blaming the shoe. We forgot to remove that, you know, the paper ball inside the shoe before wearing it.
Good point.
So there lies the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes. Like, we have to work on our problems as well. It's not just simply the blame game you start blaming.
Often, actually. You know, you know, in the beginning of the discussion, we talked about patterns, that if someone displays a pattern of disturbance and unease and trouble in my life, I will remove them. Yeah. Sometimes I'm the one creating that pattern. You know, it's not like I can remove myself from my life, but I can remove those behaviors. I can remove that mindset. Sometimes we are the bad guy.
We have to look at, you know, both sides of the story.
Yeah, so it's important to be objective, like we said in the beginning. It's really important to be objective and to see what sort of behaviorism and contribution is helping the main purpose.
Especially when we are talking about people and if it's a relationship. So we need to give some time and check if it's worth it of giving the time and effort. After that, you know, there's a certain boundary and red line.
Yes.
Inshallah, it doesn't cross the boundaries.
Inshallah.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, all the listeners, for staying with us. And thank you so much, Sister Zainab.
My pleasure.
And with that, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan, says James Risen, writer, in an article titled, "For two decades, Americans told one lie after another about what they were doing in Afghanistan." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture. Americans have hungered for a simple storyline, with heroes and villains, to make sense of the longest war in the United States history. They have wanted stories like 12 Strong to make them feel good. But at the very edge of the American empire, the war was nasty and brutish, and brought out in Americans the same imperial arrogance that doomed the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. As the Taliban swiftly take control of Kabul and the American-backed government collapse, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the government's watchdog over the Afghan experience, issued his final report. The assessment includes remarkably candid interviews with former American officials involved in shaping U.S. policy in Afghanistan that collectively offer perhaps the most biting critique of the 20-year American enterprise ever published in an official U.S. government report. The extraordinary costs were meant to serve a purpose, the report notes, though the definition of that purpose evolved over time. Released in the days after Kabul fell, the report reads like an epitaph for America's involvement in Afghanistan. One of the first things the U.S. did after gaining effective control over Afghanistan following the Taliban's ouster in 2001 was to set up secret torture chambers. Beginning in 2002, the CIA tortured both Afghans and foreign prisoners flown to these torture rooms from all over Central Asia, Africa, the West Asia, North Africa region. The war's torture chamber was nicknamed the Darkness by the prisoners sent there, who suffered such complete sensory deprivation that they did not even know they were in Afghanistan. They were chained in solitary confinement with no light and music blaring constantly. They were hung by their arms for as long as 2 days, slammed against walls, forced to lie naked on traps, while gallons of ice water were poured over their bodies. At least one prisoner died in CIA custody after being left shackled in frigid temperatures. No one was ever held to account for the American torture regime in Afghanistan. American drone strikes also started early in Afghanistan. The CIA killed Al-Qaeda operative Mohammad Atif and others with a drone there in November 2001, just 2 months after 9/11. Afghanistan soon became the beta test site for high-tech drone warfare, leading to countless civilian casualties and deep resentment among the Afghan people, who felt helpless against the unseen threats circling overhead. America's early adoption of drone warfare in Afghanistan helped make a fortune for Neil Blue, the chair of General Atomics. The Southern California Energy and Defense Corporation manufactured the Predator, the first armed drone to fly over Afghanistan. General Atomics subsequently produced the Predator's follow-on model, the Reaper. Blue and his brother, Lyndon Blue, vice chair of General Atomics, maintained low public profiles throughout the war. But as owners of privately held General Atomics, they were among the first but hardly the last American contractors to enrich themselves as blood spilled in Afghanistan. Before long, the CIA's drone campaign shifted from going after the few Al-Qaeda operatives it could find in Afghanistan to targeting the Taliban, thus placing the drone campaign squarely in the midst of Afghan domestic insurgency. The U.S. launched more than 13,000 1,000 drone strikes in Afghanistan between 2015 and 2020, killing up to 10,000 people, according to statistics kept by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The CIA, relying on cell phone numbers to find, fix, and finish its alleged enemies, often launched its Hellfire missiles at the wrong targets or at targets standing amid groups of civilians. The practice devastated Afghan villages. Yet the United States regime refused to keep track of civilian casualties from drone strikes. Instead, officials insisted that each strike had hit its intended target, while ignoring the claims of villagers that the missiles had killed a tribal chief or decimated a Minigov village elders. Along with drone strikes came night raids, in which U.S. forces would burst into a home in the middle of the night and kill or capture those inside, breeding further resentment. The raids were so deeply unpopular that they sometimes led an entire village to switch its allegiance to the Taliban. That was worse. The U.S. military and the CIA failed for years to fully grasp the degree to which their airstrikes and night raids were being manipulated by Afghans who fed them false information to convince the Americans to launch raids against their local rivals or have those rivals carted off to Guantanamo. The shift of American resources by the Bush administration to Iraq in 2002 and 2003 was the greatest military miscalculation of the entire war in Afghanistan. While the United States was distracted by Iraq, the Taliban, which had been all but defeated and dispersed, recovered and regained the strength. Yet, even as the Bush administration drew down militarily in Afghanistan, it is still insisted on creating a new pro-Western government in Kabul and began a massive nation-building project in the country. It did so without grasping the significance of several basic facts about conditions it faced. As the Taliban revived, the Bush administration had few troops left in Afghanistan to counter the threat. Within a few years of its initial victory in 2001, the United States regime was stuck in a quagmire of its own making in Afghanistan, just as it did was in Iraq. For 20 years, America essentially ran a narco state in Afghanistan. During the initial invasion and bombing campaign in 2001, the Bush administration ignored the drug problem, believing that it was a distraction from America's main counterterrorism mission, and refused to bomb drug-related facilities. The U.S. spent nearly $9 billion on its token counter-narcotics programs in Afghanistan, yet opium production and heroin smuggling in Afghanistan skyrocketed under the U.S.-backed regime. Afghanistan now produces more than 80% of the world's heroin supply. Afghanistan's opium production soared in 2002 and just kept growing. By 2020, 224,000 hectares of land were under opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan, compared with 123,000 hectares in 2010, according to the United Nations. The U.S. provided $145 billion over 20 years to rebuild a country that had a gross domestic product of just $19 billion in 2019. As recently as 2018, nearly 80% of Afghan government spending came from Western donors. The combined effects of the massive flows of Western aid dollars funding for combat operations and the river of narco dollars created a surreal economic bubble. in Afghanistan. A new Western-style urban professional class sprang up in Kabul, many of whose members are now fleeing the Taliban. But the money also triggered an epidemic of corruption and insider dealing that thoroughly discredited both the Afghan central government and the United States regime. Much of the American money enriched U.S. contractors without ever entering the Afghan economy. Much of it also disappeared into secret bank accounts in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, held by Afghan government officials, warlords, and their families. A phenomenon described in a 2020 report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as the cross-pollination of criminality between Afghanistan and Dubai. Meanwhile, petty corruption, bribes to local officials to obtain any service or job, was endemic, stoking more resentment against the government among average Afghans. The UN found that by 2012, Afghans were paying $3.9 million in bribes per year. Half of all Afghans paid a bribe for a public service. As the US-backed government continued, petty bribery and corruption grew worse, not better. Militias were using their position and closeness with the government and U.S. military to control roads, secure lucrative contracts, establish themselves as regional powers, and sometimes serve both sides, cooperating with both international and Taliban forces to maximize profits, concluded a 2018 report from the Institute of World Politics. The government-fueled bribery and corruption forced many Afghans into the arm of the Taliban, who gained the reputation of settling financial and other disputes using more straightforward, if far more brutal, methods. Trying to compete with the Taliban's dispute resolution would have meant allowing laws, and that's not something we could do politically. Barnett Robin, a longtime Afghanistan expert who advised the State Department, told the Special Inspector General. Perhaps the most cynical decision in the war in Afghanistan was taken by Obama in 2009. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Obama sought to distinguish himself from his main political rivals with his emphatic denunciations of the war in Iraq. Fearful of being attacked from the right for being too dovish, Obama balanced his attacks on the Iraq war by claiming that he would do more than the Bush administration had done to win the war in Afghanistan. In 2009, Obama announced that he was escalating U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan, his ill-considered Afghan surge. The surge came with no real long-term strategy, and it is hard not to see Obama's decision as little more than a political calculation to live up to his earlier campaign promise, which had only been made to insulate him from attacks on his position on Iraq. As American troops flowed steadily into Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010, combat operations were focused on the south, notably Helmand Province, a stronghold of both the Taliban and opium production. U.S. troop levels peaked at about 100,000 during the surge, the highest levels of the entire war in Afghanistan. But the surge quickly descended into an inconclusive war of attrition. U.S. casualties reached their highest levels of the war during the surge, with fatalities rising to 496 in 2010. Obama drew down U.S. forces to around 8,400 by the time he left office. Donald Trump came into the presidency in 2017, having campaigned on a vow to end America's forever wars. It was determined to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, but it was easily distracted by cronies eager to make money. Eric Prince, the infamous founder of Blackwater, nearly convinced Trump to let him take over the entire combat mission in Afghanistan by using paid mercenaries instead of U.S. troops. Instead, Trump got so sidetracked that he let the Pentagon talk him into increasing troop levels at about 14,000 in 2017. Trump finally got his way in February 2020 when the U.S. and the Taliban signed an agreement setting the conditions for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 1, 2021. After the 2020 presidential election, Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that U.S. troop levels had been reduced to 2,500. Joe Biden came into office this year, making the case that after 20 years, the war in Afghanistan had to end. Getting out of Afghanistan was perhaps the only issue on which he publicly agreed with Donald Trump. On April 14th, he announced that all U.S. troops would be withdrawn by September 11th, 2021, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Trump promptly criticized Biden for failing to meet the May 1st deadline. He had negotiated with the Taliban, saying that we can and should get out earlier, and that getting out of Afghanistan is a wonderful and positive thing to do. I plan to withdraw on May 1st, and we should keep as close to that schedule as possible, unquote. The Taliban also issued a statement in April criticizing Biden for failing to meet the agreed-upon deadline. They warned ominously that the delay opens the way for the Taliban to take every necessary countermeasure. In an interview with the Special Inspector General, Douglas Lute, who coordinated strategy for Afghanistan at the National Security Council from 2007 to 2013, gave a brief and devastating critique of the American enterprise in Afghanistan. Lute said, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei. in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
The goal was to encourage the people to rise for justice so that that society will be a just society. Well, we are behind in these areas and we have to work a great deal. In my opinion, every resolution that you pass and every bill that you draft in the administration and every directive that you issue in your organization should have a section on justice. You should take care not to let your decrees and your methods damage justice and violate the rights of underprivileged classes. This caution should always exist. You should ensure this with a written addendum. Or you should prepare your draft in a way that justice will be ensured. Sometimes a managerial method and a common practice do harm. We have really seen these cases. Today, too, there are some habits in our affairs that should be corrected. These habits exist in various areas, primarily in the area of justice and distributing the resources of the country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These resources should really be distributed in a fair manner. However, in the present time, this is not the case in some areas. Of course, when I say this, it does not mean that there is an ulterior motive in play. But for example, in the area of energy and oil, an official in the previous administration delivered a report to me recently showing that the hidden subsidies for oil in the year 1399 amounted to $63 billion. Well, who receives these subsidies? Who benefits more from the country's oil and petroleum resources? A significant and important number of the people do not benefit from this subsidy at all. However, officials have calculated that $63 billion, that is 1,500 billion tomans, are allocated to this subsidy, which is more than the budget for the year 1399. Well, this is only an example that I cited. Of course, I am not offering advice on oil. You should examine it on your own and see what you can do.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters. About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city center demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities' representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries, the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The night in March 2021 that 33-year-old Sarah Everard was arrested, raped and murdered by police officer Wayne Curzons. He has been handed a life sentence, but since the murder, public trust in the force has plummeted. In 4 years, 2,000 officers have been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape. nearly two-thirds of them have faced no further action, and a quarter of misconduct hearings are closed to the public. Britain's most senior police officer has promised a thorough investigation into the Met's culture, and the Independent Force for Police Conduct says it is dealing with a slew of new referrals since it changed the criteria for abuse of power for sexual purposes.
But is it about referral criteria or something more ingrained and sinister? Cousins was nicknamed the rapist by his colleagues, so why wasn't he weeded out earlier by the Met?
Climate change is sort of steroids for the weather. That's what experts say. From the northernmost to the southernmost points of the Earth, nowhere and no one is immune to this crisis. In India, people have been devastated by frequent heat waves.
We are affected a lot by this unbearable heat, and us poor are hit the hardest.
And so are Canadians.
It's just unbearable. It's impossible to be out.
This year, July was declared the world's hottest month ever recorded. A recent study shows if the world's emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continues at the same level, in 30 years' time, there will be a climate change apocalypse. That means outdoor life in parts of the Middle East and North Africa would be impossible, regions that are already facing long periods of extreme heat.
We are very tired and cannot stand in the sun. Our situation is very bad. We are exhausted.
Researchers are now warning that even animals and plants are in danger. In a bid to survive, some countries are already looking for new ways to adapt to these intense situations. In Bangladesh, one of the countries worst affected by the extreme weather in recent decades, farmers are developing floating seed beds and salt-resistant rice to avoid unpredictable conditions.
This is the digital age. We saw on YouTube how greenhouse farming works. We tried it on a smaller scale, though. I am doing greenhouse farming this year on 8,000 square feet of land.
Estimates show that $5 trillion a year are needed by 2030 to find measures to fight global warming. But despite signs of progress in a few sectors, the majority of the tasks required for curbing the rising temperatures still seem to be far-fetched. And many are now saying that the upcoming United Nations conference, COP26, is the last major chance to galvanize a collective effort to fight climate change.
Unless there are immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we will be unable to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the consequences will be catastrophic. COP26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
All these are reminders that the fatal consequences of this human-induced crisis are threatening our planet now more than ever before.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects, both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact, they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leader's remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time, came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity